Hi, good afternoon. This is Ken McDermott Rowe. The name of the show is In Context. I'm here with my fellow host, Gus Cantavero.
Hey, everybody. It's a beautiful day.
And behind the boards is our military affairs commentator, Marchand McDermott Rowe.
Good afternoon, everyone.
In Context is now on every Monday from noon to 1 p.m., except the first Monday of the month. And you can also visit our website, incontextreport.com, to get more information about our show, which is produced by MDR Productions, Inc. A couple of announcements before we get into the show, and we're looking forward to taking your calls during the show. On Saturday, October 22nd at 2 p.m., Gus, Marchand, and I will be personally appearing at the Greenwich Public Library at 101 West Putnam Avenue in Greenwich at the presentation of the Mark Twain versus the Imperialists. There'll be a reading of this one-act play based upon the political writings of Mark Twain, and Gus and Marchand and I will be available after the play to talk to you about the relevance of Mark Twain's political views to today's politics. And also on Monday, October 24th at noon, our next show here at WPKN, we're going to do a show about high-tech surveillance with Mark Dice, the author of the book Big Brother, The Orwellian Nightmare Come True. And he discusses the threat posed by high-tech surveillance by the government to our personal rights and our personal privacy. And today's show, we'd like to talk about a couple subjects, and we'd be delighted if you called in. Our call-in number, so you can jot it down if you want to call in later, it's the 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. And a lot of people are a little shy about calling in. If you prefer to drop us an email during the show, we'll read it on the air or read your comment. So just send us a note to Ken at mdrtalk.org. That's Ken at mdrtalk.org, and we'll read your question, your comment on the air. So you can send that in during the show. We'll get access to it. The couple subjects we'd like to pursue today, one is the accusation by the United States government that some American Iranians were plotting to kill a Saudi envoy. And that plot was alleged just a few days ago. Attorney Eric Holder claimed that Iran had directed and approved high levels in the Iranian government had directed and approved this assassination scheme. And the other subject we want to talk about today is the sudden rise in the polls of Republican presidential candidate Herman Cain. Who is Herman Cain, and what's bringing his popularity about? And why does he, what does it mean to the other candidates? Is he going to affect the race overall? So, Gus, which one would you like to address first? You want to talk about Herman Cain? Or
sure, let's start with that. But, Marsh, we already have a phone call. Someone backed up.
Yes, we do.
Go ahead, caller.
Go ahead, caller.
Where are you calling from?
New Haven, Connecticut.
All right, and what's your comment? Go ahead, caller. What's your comment? Oh, well.
I think the call got dropped.
All right, so
okay, call. Give us a ring back in case that was just some problem on your phone. We can try again.
So why don't we start with the Herman Cain stuff, and then we'll, because I don't know if that's going to take all that long. The last debate was broadcast only on Bloomberg TV and online. It wasn't on standard cable networks like Fox or CBS, NBC, none of those, CNN. So it wasn't really as well attended or by the viewership. So, I mean, a lot of the things that were said, there wasn't really anything big said, except that there was a little bit more detail given and a little bit more cross-analysis from the candidates asking each other some more questions. And I think it was actually one of the more important debates yet.
Why so?
That Perry, again, is not prepared, that he is nothing but canned answers. If he's asked anything off the cuff, he really is not prepared for it. He's not ready to defend any of his positions in detail. If you get him off his path, he just is floundering. And I just can't wait for those poll numbers to drop
to single
digits.
It seems that vagueness has been mandatory for presidential candidates for a long time. But you've got to be good at being vague, like President Obama was during the last campaign. He gave people the impression he was against the war, but actually he expanded the war.
Right, and it's a great tactic because Romney is strategically vague. Whenever he's asked a question, he's quickly vague, so that it doesn't even think – it doesn't seem like he's thinking about how vague he is. You know, it's President Romney, what do you think about the war? Well – I obviously think that we need to check with the generals on the ground before any decision is made. And I would say, oh, that's very astute. You know, that's very wise. On Herman Cain specifically, though, he's the one who got the biggest bump in the polls recently. He's taken the place of where previously Michelle Bachmann was at 30-something percent, and then Romney was for a short time, and then Perry was in the 30s. And then drop down again. And now Cain is up there in the 30s. And it really seems like people jump on the bandwagon who aren't quite paying attention. All the people who are so desperate to find a front runner, they say, I like this guy's attitude and his candidness, so I'll pick him when the polar calls me.
And here we see, again, the power of the corporate media in picking our candidates, because if they give someone a lot of airtime, and if they speak about him in a way which enhances his credibility,
right,
he becomes automatically a significant candidate. On
right.
the other hand, if they ignore you, mm-hmm. then you're never going to get any place.
You don't exist. And when MSNBC or CNN or Fox or even NPR talks about Herman Cain, they always say the businessman Herman Cain with his refreshing perspective. You know, he's an outsider. He's not a politician. Well, okay, the guy's been trying to be a politician for almost 20 years.
That's right. He ran. He's never been successful. He ran for the Senate in Georgia, right? And got nowhere.
Right. As I wrote at a blog posting on our blog this week.
Which you can see at incontextreport.com.
Yeah, I detail that he ran for governor of Georgia and lost in the primary, came in a distant second place. I think he got something like 25%, and the winner got 54%,
yeah.
So it was overwhelming.
Yeah,
it wasn't
serious
even close.
Money, I'm sure, behind him. Yeah.
Right, and then he also ran for the Senate and lost that, and he was a economic advisor to the Dole Kemp campaign in the mid-90s, I think it was 96, and this is his second run for president. So he's been trying to get into politics for a long time.
He's not
time.
Exactly a fresh face. And we really know where he's coming from because, although it's brought up, he doesn't bring it up, is the fact that he was head of one of the regional Federal Reserve Banks.
He was chairman of the Kansas City Federal Reserve Bank. He was first a deputy chairman and then elevated to chairman. And he was there for, I think, about 4 years. And that's not a long time. That's not 20 years or anything like that. But it does say that he was identified early on as a potential candidate for something. And after leaving there, he went right into trying to run for office. And I guess, you know, the big machine didn't get behind him until they thought it was his time,
yeah.
Which is obviously now.
Now, yeah, yeah.
When he tries to paint himself as an outsider, he's anything but an outsider.
Absolutely. He really represents the corporate government that we've got, dominated by the large private banks, and that's what the Federal Reserve is. And there was a very interesting article I just saw in the Washington Post yesterday called Herman Cain's Deep Ties to the Koch Brothers Are Key to His Campaign. And apparently he is very close to these two billionaire brothers. What are they in? Oil, gas, and chemicals. The same brothers who basically created the Tea Party movement. They paid for the website. They put it together. They got Richard Armey, the former Republican House leader, and his organization to push it. The whole thing was ginned up by the Koch brothers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And apparently for quite a few years now, he has been a functionary of their group called Americans for Prosperity, which typically with the Koch brothers wants less government regulation and to cut social welfare spending. And he's been going around the country for years pitching the Koch brothers' agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, a lot of his aides, according to this Washington Post article, October 16th, have come from this American for Prosperity operation, and including his campaign manager, a man named Block, who traveled with him throughout his extensive speeches for the Americans for Prosperity. He also, the law firm that represents the campaign of Cain represents the Americans for Prosperity firm.
Mm-hmm.
And he's credited a Cleveland businessman named Rich Lowe, who was on the AFP's board of directors, as his key economic advisor who came up with this 999 tax plan.
Right.
So this is where Herman Cain is coming from.
Right. And you mentioned, one, his economic advisor, and two, the 999 plan. I have a clip that I want to play. And just to set this up, first of all, the 999 plan, I find despicable. It's a 9% business tax, 9% income tax, and a 9% national sales tax. And people have been talking about this as the fair tax for a long time, but I find it to be anything but fair. It's completely an unfair tax. It affects low-income tax brackets far more disproportionately than wealthy people. Wealthy
sure.
people can afford a consumption tax.
Sure.
Poor people can't afford to have an additional 9% put on top of their grocery bill.
That's right.
Right?
And I think people recognize that, whether they're Republicans or Democrats. That's
yeah.
pretty obvious.
Yeah, and to give the government an additional revenue stream is not where we want to go right now, because they're going to keep the income tax, they're going to keep the business taxes, all the fees, all the regulations, and they're just going to get an additional 9% out of
those. And they'll be shifting the burden down, because presumably this huge regressive sales, national sales tax, is going to allow them to maintain low tax rates for the very wealthy.
Right.
And meanwhile, the average guy is going to go out there and see an extra 8%. What in Connecticut he'd be paying like 16% on everything
right.
bought.
Right. Because what would happen to the state sales taxes? How could the government, federal government, tell the states that they're not allowed to collect income tax anymore?
Of course they have to, because they're mostly running deficits anyway.
Right. They have to get their money from someplace.
We're talking about the Republican campaign right now. You're listening to In Context with Gus and Ken and Marchand. And if you'd like to join the conversation, feel free to give us a call at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. Or if you prefer, you can email us at ken@mdrtalk.org. And we'll read your comment or your question on the air. It's ken@mdrtalk.org.
So we're going to play this clip of Herman Cain being interviewed by Chuck Todd on MSNBC. And it's only about a minute and a half long, but it sets up exactly where he's coming from on his predictions. Because one of the reasons why I really like Ron Paul is because he's been right on a lot of stuff. He's been open with his predictions, and he's been proven accurate over time. Where I think that when you're vetting a candidate, you have to see where have they been over the past 5 years during this economic downturn. Did they predict it? Did they see it coming? Did they have fixes for it? I want to know. So let's hear what Herman Cain's record is on predictions.
I would say this. How do you reassure voters that despite all the experience you're running on in the business community, your time on the Fed, you missed the housing bubble and you missed the economic collapse?
Well, it's real simple, Chuck. I have economic advisors working with me now who spend time studying these various analyses. When I wrote those papers, I was only responding to reports that I, like everybody else, was getting through the media. Those kind of public reports. I wouldn't.
Which turned out to be right, by the way. You were criticizing those reports, but they turned out to be right.
Well, yeah, but what I'm saying is I will have people around me who are going to help me do deeper analyses on some of these things, okay? So, yeah, I miss some of these things. I'm not perfect. I'm very quick to say I made a mistake or I missed it, but I didn't have sophisticated analyses helping me to draw the conclusions that I was drawing at that time. And remember, I have admitted the housing bubble and the economic meltdown of 2008, it was much worse than I ever realized until the Lehman Brothers situation started and until more and more was revealed about the depth of the problems at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. I admit I didn't know all of the details about those situations.
Okay, so he had no idea when it was coming. He was actually dead wrong on the fact that it was going to be bad. And afterward, he went on to try to claim innocence and say that, well, I was only going off what the media was telling me.
Right.
And then Chuck Todd says, but you were criticizing what the media was telling you. You were actually refuting it. And he said, well, yeah, but what I'm trying to tell you is that now I'm going to have economic advisors giving me the skinny. Okay, come on, man. You can't have it both ways. You can't say that I missed it because I was only listening to what you told me, but the reason I was wrong is because now I don't have the right advisors.
Well, it sounds like he has a pretty superficial grasp of the economy.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, I don't think we should single Herman Cain out for being unqualified.
No, but he is the one that Zogby says has 38% support.
Exactly.
Right.
He's rising so fast in the polls. But I think if we examined some of the other candidates, we'd find they weren't too well informed either.
Right. And he even, when pressed on foreign policy, he says, I don't have a foreign policy yet.
Because why would you run for president if you didn't have any ideas on?
Well, it seems like the only thing that he's really running on is giving the government more of our money.
Yeah.
Or actually getting the Federal Reserve more of our money because we have to pay them interest on all the money that they create.
Right, right. Well, as I look at the presidential race, it seems once again we're having candidates a limited range of candidates that are foisted on us because they're acceptable to the corporate government. We don't get the full range. And when somebody else comes along who really has fresh ideas, whether it's, say, Dennis Kucinich on the Democratic side or Ron Paul on the Republican side, they get very poor coverage.
I mean, how come there isn't a primary opponent for Obama yet? Why is there no one wishing to challenge him? I don't understand it.
I'd like what listeners have to what their thoughts on this. Should somebody run against Obama in the primaries, someone probably an anti-war candidate who feels he's more in touch with the Democratic Party? And if you want to sway in on this election issue, it's 203-336-9756. It's 203-336-9756, or email us at ken@mdrtalk.org. I really think somebody should run against Obama.
Well, I was thinking about this the other day in preparation for the show. I was thinking, well, maybe it's because the establishment is so stuck up that they'll never admit that they made a mistake by backing Obama the first time.
Yeah.
And if they distance themselves by allowing a primary, really, which is really a free republic, that's what a free democracy does.
Right.
We challenge opponents and we question our own ideas and goals. But to say that they made a mistake by essentially hiring the wrong guy.
Yeah, right.
does that mean that they reduce their own credibility? Because today's macho culture is to say, basically back yourself up no matter what. No matter how wrong you are, never admit defeat.
But they hired the right guy. When they got Obama, they got
exactly what they got.
Every 4 years, folks, it's Tweedledum, Tweedledee. We get a choice between two pro-war candidates, two candidates that are not going to do what has to be done to get this economy going again, which we talk about a lot on the show, which is we got to end the war and invest in America. We got to create high-paying jobs and make this country more competitive. And that's the only way we're going to get back in the game. And we keep getting a choice of people. It's always off the table. I don't hear any debate about the war during the campaign. And that's what's hanging over this economy.
Right. And the media obviously is not doing us any favors because all they do is toe the party line, you know, whatever it is. And I think the main overall point here is that both parties are controlled by puppet strings from a higher power.
Oh, absolutely. And along those lines, there's an article in today's Wall Street Journal on Republican financing. Mm-hmm. And the headline is Romney is mining Wall Street.
Mm.
A quarter of his large contributions have come from Wall Street firms.
And he's raised $14 million.
The money is rolling in. And folks, these are the people who own your government. Now, we got to talk about how we get our government back. And it's not just the Republicans, because just to stick with Romney, he's getting his money from the hedge funds. Rick Perry, he's getting his money from oil and gas firms. So we have basically, we've been sidelined, ladies and gentlemen. We are just spectators in this.
Perry actually won't release his sources. He's not going to release it until after everything's over. It's his choice to do so. You can either make it all public or you can keep it private. And Perry's the only one who has kept his sources private.
According to the Wall Street Journal, it's the energy industry is what's keeping him afloat.
Okay, so maybe he's not disclosing the names of the people, but maybe the industries
is getting it from. But it's not just the Republicanos. If you think that your Democrats are any better, there's an article in the New York Times 2 days ago on fundraising and bundlers. And President Obama, well, bundlers are well-connected people who call their friends and say, I have a friend of mine from law school who did this for a Democratic candidate.
Uh-huh.
You call your friends who've got a few bucks. And you invite them to a party, and then they all kick in $1,000 each. And then in this case, his bundlers have raised more than $500,000 each. He has 351 bundlers that have raised for Obama $55.5 million.
And I also seen, I think it was the New York Times or maybe it was Bloomberg, that said that Obama has raised even a higher percentage of his money this time from Wall Street than he did last time.
Yeah, yes. Wall Street's calling
the truth, folks. Say that, you know, Obama's backing the Occupy Wall Street movement is a complete sham because he's raising even more money from Wall Street.
I think we have a call, guys.
Okay, sure. Caller, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from a few blocks from PKN. This is Johnny B. Good.
All right. How are you?
Hi. How you doing, John?
Anybody talk about Bernie Sanders for president?
Bernie Sanders for president, the socialist from, was it Vermont?
Yeah. Do you think he would run? I mean, if you...
I wish he would. I wish somebody would start talking him up. He's the only guy that's on target.
I'm pretty sure he said that he wouldn't challenge Obama in the primary. He was asked about it. I'm pretty sure he said he would not.
Maybe we got to pull on his coattails a little bit or something. You need a candidate. You're talking about who else you got?
I think that anybody, any credible person who ran against Obama in the primary would do really well. However, if he's an incumbent, it would end his career.
Yeah, well, he's got a lot of energy. He's still, you know, somebody ought to hook up with him or something. Utilize what the man's saying.
I like Bernie Sanders. I mean, I don't particularly agree with his viewpoints or his solutions on things, but I do think that he's a man of integrity.
And he'd give Obama a real run for his money and say the New Hampshire
primary. He could debate him honestly on all the topics.
Oh, he would. Yeah, he'd be great. But I don't know if he wants to jeopardize his position in the Senate.
No, it's a cushy job.
Yeah, it's a nice job. And I think nowadays, if you remember back, I remember back in 1968 when incumbent senators, and maybe you do too, John. Eugene McCarthy and Robert Kennedy challenged an incumbent president, and they had a lot of courage, and they went out there and paid off, and Lyndon Johnson withdrew from the race. But I don't see that kind of an atmosphere anymore where people are willing to challenge an incumbent.
Well, Trump is jeopardizing his career anyhow by speaking out on all these issues, and he just put down the Korea deal that they just made the other day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you don't... get behind somebody like him, the thing's going to just roll by and we're going to have the same old thing.
Yeah. Well, nobody in the Democrat power structure, beside a very select few, actually vote against Obama's pet projects. I mean, who else is nationally notable, like Nancy Pelosi? I mean, they are nothing but pets.
Oh, I'll tell you, she wouldn't be a bad candidate either.
She's awful.
I support Nancy Pelosi.
I would give every dollar I have to make sure that she was never president.
Oh, well, I would give every dollar I have to make sure she would be.
I'm sure there are a lot of congressmen in the Democratic Congress.
She's been on the right side of the right issues on everything.
Well, she loves war. She loves torture. She loves illegal wiretaps. I can't see how she's been right on a single thing. She loves bailouts. I mean, Bernie Sanders has at least questioned the Federal Reserve on where they're putting their money. Pelosi has done nothing but cover up for all the illegalities taking place.
She hasn't covered up. She's spoken out on a lot of things.
No.
But
wouldn't
you think, even on a kind of a opportunistic level, wouldn't you think that some politician would see this as an opportunity? I mean, you've got a tremendously unpopular president, unpopular with the people at large, but unpopular with his own party for his pro-war policy, for his failure to do anything significant about unemployment. You'd think that somebody out there, some office holder might say, hey, there's an opening for me.
Sure.
A lot of these politicians will say anything to become president, like Obama did. But then something happens once they get in there, they get their arms twisted or they get threatened or something.
Well, you know,
I don't think Sanders, anybody could threaten that guy.
Well, I mean, I guarantee the same thing.
In there, if he said something, that's what he would do.
I guarantee the same exact thing would happen with someone like Pelosi. You get Barney Frank and Pelosi, they're the same people. They talk something up and then they vote for it anyway. And then afterward, they hem and haw about how they were against it. But when it comes down to it, their vote is what really counts. And they never go against the party.
Pelosi was fighting members in her party. She was she wasn't going along with all. Anyhow,
all right.
That's just something to think about.
Well, thanks.
You guys doing a good job. I'll talk to you later.
Thanks for calling.
Bye bye.
All right, and just to close off this topic, we were talking about how complicit the mainstream media is. I looked at a transcript from Jim Lehrer, the NewsHour, recently, and they're just kind of running down the candidates, you know, and it's kind of predictable. And you have a guest on, his name is Mark Shields, and he says, well, you would have to say, and this is talking about, I think, Romney. He says, well, you'd have to say that he has a cap as far as his popularity is concerned. And he says, you look at the Wall Street Journal NBC poll, he was at 23% in June, he bumped up to 30% in July, back down to 23% in August, and now in October he's at 23%. And this is after four, what one could say, were polished professional performances at the debate. And then Jim Lehrer responds by saying, the consensus was he won every one of those debates.
Yeah, this is completely
ludicrous.
Well,
yeah.
That's a PBS.
Every single online poll afterwards that Ron Paul won every debate.
It also shows to me that the networks, that PBS really is any different from the networks in trying to marginalize this guy.
Mm-hmm.
Because the corporations don't have to get together to know that Ron Paul's bad for them.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I mean, here's a man who wants not only to audit the Federal Reserve, he'd like to replace it.
Yeah, nationalize.
It's the linchpin of the corporate government, which I wish the people in the Occupy Wall Street movement could really focus on the money issue and focus on the specifics of replacing the Federal Reserve Bank, this private banking cartel that controls our money supply and to a large extent our public policy, replacing it with a publicly owned national bank that would charge no interest for money it creates for the American people and that would finance the kind of massive infrastructure programs that we need to get America working again and get America competitive again.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Why don't we jump to the Iranian plot now?
And let me just give out the phone number again. Okay, you're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport. The name of the show, In Context, we're a live call-in radio show. And our phone number here is 203-336-9756. To join the conversation, call 203-336-9756 or email us at ken@mdrtalk.org, and we'll read your comment or your question on the line. My name is Ken McDermott Rowe. I'm here with Gus Cantavero and Marchand McDermott Rowe.
All right, so recently, you may have heard about it. There was a completely absurd plot that was discussed in the news by a gentleman by the name of, I have all these notes here. What's his name?
Mansour
Arbabsiar?
Arbabsiar.
Yeah, Arbabsiar.
Arbabsiar.
He's a 56-year-old guy. He's a naturalized American citizen. He's from Corpus Christi, Texas. And he was recently arrested. Well, not recently, actually. What was it, back in September of last year?
Is that when?
It's been a year going now. They didn't announce it because they were still wiretapping his phone calls and trying to pretend that he was still free so that he could communicate with the people in Iran. And the whole plot was, well, as the Justice Department lays it out, was that he was going to try to hire the Los Zetas, which is the most powerful drug gang in Mexico, which is intimately tied to the American intelligence agencies, the BATF, because that's who's implicated in the gun-running scandals, Operation
right.
Fast and Furious, Operation Gunwalker. And Attorney General Holder is really in some hot water over this because he knew about it, he lied about knowing about it, and said that he didn't know about it, and other people said that he didn't, and he said he
did. Are you talking about the gun running?
Yeah, this is gun running. So,
yeah.
I'm just setting this up because I think it's intimately tied.
It hurts his credibility.
The Los Zetas are really important in this story. I think it's more important than the Iran side. So the plot was that they was going to hire Los Zetas to bomb a restaurant or a building or wherever that the Saudi Arabian ambassador was going to be in Washington, D.C.
Right.
And this guy is described by everyone who knew him as a bumbling fool. You know, he was the one person quoted who knew him said, well, if they were looking for 007, they got Mr. Bean. I mean, they said that his socks didn't match. He often lost his keys and his cell phone. He was always disheveled. His shirts were unbuttoned.
He was at best a nice guy, but a complete loser. And other people didn't have a good word to say about him. They said he couldn't organize himself.
I don't know.
Have you seen Johnny English? I mean, it's entirely possible. Rowan Atkinson pulled it off.
Well, he said the deal was $1.5 million he was going to pay to Los Zetas to do this this hit. And presumably that money was coming from Iran because according to Attorney General Eric Holder, the operation was, quote, directed and approved by elements of the Iranian government and especially senior members of the Quds Force.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but Marchand, I think you've looked into this. What is the Quds Force?
Well, the Quds Force is it's the Iranian Special Forces. They were founded in the 1980s during the Iran-Iraq War. And to give you some etymology behind the name, Quds is the Arabic word for Jerusalem. So these are the elite of the Iranian army. And in connection with that, they're modeled very similarly, and I don't know if this is intentionally or not, off of the U.S. Army's Green Berets, the U.S. Army Special Forces. What their main mission is to go behind enemy lines and train resistance fighters. So some of their first action was training the Kurdish militias in the north of Iraq during the Iran-Iraq War to fight against Saddam at the time when we were backing Saddam and fighting the Kurds. They also went to the south of Iraq to train the Shiite militias. They trained Massoud and his Northern Alliance to fight the Russians and later on to fight the Taliban, again, before we were officially supporting the Northern Alliance. And then also, the most successful operation was to train Hezbollah. And they're credited with being the force that made Hezbollah a formidable military force. So they have been noted to also train Hamas and various other Palestinian organizations. So this kind of terrorist-type, insurgent attack of sorts, assassination plots, it's not in their MO. They've never participated in stuff like this. Crude than what the Quds Force usually does. Additionally, also—
They're highbrow.
Yeah, they're very highbrow. You know, it's they train insurgents. So more likely than not, they would be training resistance fighters. And again, they don't operate that far from the Middle East.
Yeah, assassinating someone in the United States would seem to be a part of their...
More than anything, to match their method of operation, wouldn't they rather send an elite force to Mexico to train the Los Zetas to cause border strife on the Mexican-Texas border?
Precisely.
Wouldn't that make more sense for them?
Precisely. There's no way on earth they would hire some bumbling fool. And least of all, his nickname, interestingly enough, this fellow...
Arbobsier.
His nickname is Jack because he drinks an immense amount of Jack Daniels, according to one of his friends I saw interviewed on CNN.
And openly smokes a lot of marijuana.
Now, the members of the Quds Force are devout Muslims, and they would, you wouldn't catch them out there boozing. So, and they wouldn't hire a bumbling boozer, failed car salesman. They're more professional than that. So it doesn't make sense. It's not their MO. It'd be like the Speznots hiring this guy. It's very unbelievable.
Well, why would they trust something really important to a complete moron, right? I mean, doesn't that just reek of irresponsibility?
They wouldn't. And the other thing that's interesting, too, is the connection to the Quds Force is very, very loose. I saw President Obama give a speech recently. It was actually during a conference with the a press conference with the president of South Korea, which I think much to the annoyance of the president of South Korea, President Obama said, "We have evidence. We have evidence." Never cited any of the evidence, but we have evidence that proves the attorney general has proven that Iran is behind this, and the evidence is mounting. And of course, there is none.
We've heard stuff like that before, and a lot of the mainstream commentators are echoing what you're saying, Marchand. Hillary Leverett, who was the director of Iran, Afghanistan, and Persian Gulf affairs for the National Security Council under Bush Jr., said the plot was totally contrary to Iranian foreign policy. And in her interview on CNN, she mentioned a couple of times the yellow cake uranium fraud that was used in the
beginning. We have that clip.
We have that clip?
Yeah.
Do we go to that?
Yeah, why don't you play that clip now? This is her saying how the plot makes no sense.
What we've seen unfold makes no sense in terms of Iran's national security strategy. There's no benefit, there's no payoff from them pursuing this kind of hit against Al-Jubeir, and it runs contrary to their entire national security strategy. So
does that make the allegations implausible, or are the allegations plausibly accusing the Iranians of something stupid?
Well, you know, any allegation is plausible, but I also served in the Bush administration in the lead up to the Iraq War, where I saw a lot of allegations come through paid informants like Ahmed Chalabi, and I raised questions about them inside the Bush administration, and everyone said, "Oh, but we know the nature of Saddam Hussein's regime, so even if it's stupid, they're so bloodthirsty, they would probably do it anyway." Well, here the questions really need to be asked again, and this time taken really seriously, because this would be such a significant departure for the Iranian government to be involved in something like this.
Yeah, and exactly.
This is coming from a high official in the Bush Jr.
Yeah, in the beginning of this interview, this is from an interview from CNN recently. She lays out how much she knows. She said, "Look, I dealt with these people on a daily basis. I was there. I spoke to them. I know them intimately. I know the inside and the out of this operation, the way they do business. This is not the way they do things."
No, and anybody looking at the history of Iran and the history of the Quds Force, it's completely, completely ludicrous. I mean, you don't have to be a military expert or a diplomat, for that matter, to be able to understand this doesn't make any sense.
So this again suggests what we're all pointing to, is it probably an agent provocateur. And there was a story in IPS News on 13 October, which also supported that. It revealed that the amended criminal complaint, which is some kind of an accusatory instrument, I think, in this case, indicates that the idea for this plot originated and was strongly pushed by an undercover DEA informant. This undercover informant was apparently a friend of the aunt of the accused.
Yeah, and that's okay, even kind bizarre, of – that's really it? Shady. She's not named at all. And well, she says she won't give an interview because her employer doesn't like employees giving media interviews. Like,
okay,
this has anything to do with her
job. So this is how this crazy case starts. And according to this government document, this accusatory document, the main purpose of the first meeting – was to arrange a deal to sell large amounts of opium from Afghanistan
right.
and Mexico.
Yeah.
They didn't
the
have
opium
with
fields
it.
That the American soldiers are guarding.
Right, exactly. The opium business that's flourishing now that we've conquered Afghanistan.
Right.
So it certainly looks like this is something cooked up, agent provocateur, in order to, again, isolate Iran, which is part of our broader strategy, to isolate and eventually take over Iran.
Well, go ahead, Mark.
Oh, it was something actually Hillary Leverett pointed out, which was very, very interesting, I thought, was she said it's almost a sign of the growing power of Iran and the waning power of the U.S. in the Middle East,
right,
our waning
right.
influence. I mean, one thing that I think is significant is the fact that Muqtada al-Sadr, who's the head of the Mahdi army, the main Shiite militia, and a member of the Iraqi parliament, said that if the U.S. doesn't leave Iraq by December 31st in its entirety, doesn't leave, you know, no force staying behind, no 10,000 troops, everyone gone, he will begin attacks on U.S. on the remaining U.S. troops after December 31st. And the Iraqi government wouldn't grant the immunity to American troops serving in Iraq. So instead of the U.S. coming in and saying, well, you know, you got to do this or else, Obama capitulated and agreed to withdraw all of the U.S. forces from Iraq by December 31st, with the exception of 150 or so that'll stay behind to guard the embassy.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, this demonstrates the influence of Iran and the waning influence of the U.S. in the region. I think to a great extent this is what it's about. There's also an interesting article on Press TV, which I actually just brought up just a few minutes ago. We have this nifty little computer in the station. And it's a report from the Pakistani ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Service, and it was reported in the Pakistani language Urdu language newspaper Ummat Daily. And the Pakistani ISI claims that this man, Mansour Arbabsir, was given false IDs, fake documents by the Israeli Mossad 3 months ago, and he was due to conduct an operation named False Fling on behalf of the Mossad, which is it's a very interesting claim to be coming out of the Pakistani ISI.
Well, explain it. Why would there be some connection between the Pakistani ISI and this guy?
Oh, is this guy really a double agent? He's not actually an idiot. It's all a cover story?
Very possibly. Or the Mossad might have been in on the setup. A lot of reports coming out of Israel, you know, from agents from members of the Israeli Mossad have said how Israel wants to provoke a war with Iran, so it's entirely possible.
Okay, so this all – and there is a history of the CIA and the Mossad cooperating in operations, so this all starts to make a little sense.
Exactly.
Right, because isn't this really all about Israel's impatience with Iran and trying to
Israel
rally support?
Would love for us to attack.
So I think it's a double-edged dagger here at home. It paints Iran as an enemy, and at the same time, it draws in – the cover story for Fast and Furious with the Los Zetas down in Texas.
Right, right. You're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, a live call-in show. And if you'd like to call join our conversation, we're at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. Or if you'd like, you can email us at ken@mdrtalk.org. And you speak to Ken, Gus, and Marchand.
And we have a call. And caller, where are you coming from? Are you there, caller?
Hello?
Hello?
I think you must have gotten cut off.
Give us a ring back, caller.
Well, we do have one more track to play. And this is where Hillary Leverett was asked about essentially if the evidence is a fraud, because everybody who understands this stuff, every intelligence agent I've seen interviewed has come out and said that this does not make any sense, and we need to be more careful with the evidence before we all jump to conclusions, which is an approach I wish we took 10 years ago,
sure,
before we got into Afghanistan and Iraq, based on completely fraudulent information. March, why don't we play that last track?
Is it a well-meaning mistake by the investigators who work for the Justice Department and the Obama administration, or is this an intentional fraud? If these allegations aren't true, why are they making them?
Well, I certainly, as an American, find it very hard to believe that there could be an intentional fraud. But I also served in the Bush administration when there was an intentional fraud in the manufacture of documents from Niger to show that Saddam Hussein had purchased yellow cake there. That was an intentional fraud. That wasn't a mistake. That wasn't reasonable analysts looking at the same material and coming to reasonable conclusions. There was an intentional fraud. So I think it really behooves us to look very carefully at the information that's being provided in the complaint, which, as a Harvard-trained lawyer, is pretty thin, and to ask really tough questions, have that information examined, and critically important, cross-examined, because we should not be going to war again on false pretenses.
Well, I think the question of war is far in the distance. I don't think reasonable people are really making that point from within the administration.
Well, but if the allegations are true, they are an act of war. If the allegations are true that the Iranian government ordered the murder of a diplomat, of an official of another country here in Washington, that has been a casus belli in other conflicts in history. So these are very grave allegations. And even though it's hard to imagine our country going to war again, we could be priming the pump here from going from virtual conflict, which we have now with Iran, to hot conflict. It can happen very quickly, and we should take it very seriously.
Okay, we're speaking.
And that, again, was a Bush Jr. administration, high-level and National Security Council official.
And it takes a lot of guts to come out and admit that those papers were fraudulent. You know, like the Downing Street memos.
That's right.
You know, the list goes on and on.
That's right. The Downing Street memos, which showed that Bush and
Tony Blair
were intentionally cooking evidence in order to support the war.
Yeah, they talked about it
Iraq.
Multiple times. You know, they corresponded with each other, just saying we need to get support for this.
And listeners, you have to be very skeptical, because if you look at the history of the last 10 years, as Gus mentioned, all these wars have begun based upon deception, on falsehoods, to get the American people to support war. And so you have to look at any new efforts to get us to go to war with a very critical eye, because they may be trying to do the same thing again. After all, it's worked before.
And from a military perspective, this is the worst possible time imaginable for us to go to war. This is not something to be taken lightly. I mean, when we went into Iraq in 2003, we went in on false pretenses, but we bombed the heck out of the country. 4,000 Americans died, which is horrible. But at the time,
and 1.5 million Iraqis are now dead too.
And 1.5 million Iraqis. But even at that time, we had the military capacity. At this time, we don't have the military capacity. I read in the Army Times the size of the U.S. force is being cut down by from over 500,000 active duty to less than 500,000. It's going to be about 400,000 active duty troops, which isn't enough to sustain a war.
No, it's completely impossible to sustain a war right now. I heard Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer interviewed just yesterday on Friday, and he said that his sources from inside the Pentagon said that they do not have the capacity to mount another offensive unless we completely abandon one of the fronts. It's just impossible.
We're overextended.
Completely overextended.
I think we have a caller.
And we have a caller. Where are you calling from?
Yes, thanks, folks. I had a problem with my cell phone. I could hear you, but you couldn't hear me. John from Westbrook. I wanted to backtrack a little bit before I started having phone trouble and mention that this Iranian from Texas was apparently interacting with a double agent in the Zeta gang.
Correct.
Part of, you know, and what it causes me to be really, really curious about how we can have an agent in a gang down there,
mm-hmm.
on top of Fast and Furious,
uh-huh.
but these people are committing murders and doing all kinds of criminal activity, and apparently we got people embedded down there that are party to this stuff?
Exactly. And the Zetas have given multiple interviews with key kingpins who have been arrested, saying that they not only bought guns from agents who brought them down to Mexico from Texas, they actually just bought them directly from the DEA, from the FBI, when they couldn't get enough guns.
Right. And there's also the idea that this goes back to the Bush administration as well.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not trying to say that one administration is more complicit than another. It's a continuity of agenda. It's the exact same thing happening over the course of multiple presidencies.
Strikes me as awesome that our agenda can include, you know, having agents in a gang.
Right.
I mean, this is this is a bunch of children playing with dangerous toys. I mean, it really begs the question of what the American people are getting for their dollars, you know?
Well, you know, we do have a long history of our government of dealing with drug dealers in order to finance covert operations back to the origins of the CIA in the 1950s.
Well, we had a call last week about the CIA's budget. Do you remember that? And you brought up the deep state.
Right.
And then we talked about how the CIA actually finances itself through illegal trades and front groups and stuff like that. This is where they get their money, the drug trade. They import the opium. They sell it to the Mexicans, the marijuana. They allow them to sell it inside the United States government. In return, they give them weapons so that they can fight for control of their own country down in Mexico. And that's where the CIA gets its money.
Based on this, first off, we're busy destabilizing another government, I assume, legitimate government. And we're also very busy in we're kind of farming terror. Of course, there's no surprise the United States has been doing this.
Mm-hmm.
It's just awesome that they've been able to get away with it. I mean, they're trying to destabilize the country on our border. We've got all kinds of agreements and treaties,
mm-hmm.
and it looks like their collusion is such that they're actually trying to bring about the downfall of the Mexican government.
Well, the Mexican government itself is a failed state. Its army is one of the major drug gangs down in Mexico. The Zetas is one of the official ones, and I forget the name of the other one that's opposing them. All the border wars, all the drug wars going on in Mexico is between the official drug gang and the unofficial drug gang. The cartel is trying to fight, and the reports are that the Zetas are going to officially take control of the government in 2012. That's the year that they have that they've pinpointed for their official coup to overthrow.
But it's not like, though, that President Calderon was any opponent of the drug gangs either. In fact, he was sponsored by several of the leading drug cartel families, I believe the one that controlled northern Mexico.
Mm. One would have to presume that his ability to attain office would have to be in part by collusion. I'd like to, it's a little bit far afield, but this leads me to think that the present campaign against marijuana in this country and the fact that all these people be incarcerated is actually an attempt to kind of like keep the operation viable.
Well, sure. Yeah. If something isn't illegal, it loses it. It's a high cost and, you know, the black market risk that goes into it. So it becomes very expensive.
You got to wonder whose hand is in whose pocket when you get all done with this nonsense between what the administration is doing.
Well, and hundreds of billions of dollars have been laundered through the major financial institutions in the United States, like Wachovia when it was bought by what's that group, that other bank that bought it?
Wells Fargo?
Wells Fargo.
Yeah,
they had to go through a serious internal audit, and it was revealed that $300 billion had been laundered in cash through their branches from the marijuana cartels.
And you know, as I learned when I did a show for the series History Counts on the Opium Wars, the connection between American businessmen and the drug trade goes back to the early 1800s. The richest man in America in the early 1800s, a man named Stephen Girard in Philadelphia,
mm-hmm.
was an opium importer.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes way back. So when these guys started getting to drugs, and the light bulb went on in my head, I mean, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's grandfather was an opium dealer.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
We're talking
about the times it was legal to medicinize it and whatnot.
Well, this is it was illegal in China, and the opium mm-hmm. wars were fought by Britain to compel the importation.
I don't understand what the British had to do with opium. My goodness, they brought it into the country.
They brought it in. They devastated China, which it seems to me, listener, has two relevances today. One is that the elite in America, the CIA-connected people, have been familiar and then profited from the drug trade for 200 years. And the second thing is the Chinese are ready for payback because we devastated that country. I mean, virtually their entire government was addicted, their emperor all the way down, their leadership cadre addicted to drugs. And this went on until Mao came in after World War II.
And many of our most powerful political families here in the United States are connected to either drug trade or rum running or alcohol during Prohibition.
Yes.
I mean, John McCain married into a family that got its money from running alcohol through the Canadian border. And I know that Warren Buffett made a lot of, not him himself, but his father made money from the drug trade as well. So, I mean, people who are, you know, you think as really important members of our society, upstanding people, they're nothing but trash. They're filth.
But, listener, do you think there's any chance that in the present political climate we will medicalize drugs instead of criminalizing it?
You know, I used to think so. I actually used to believe it was just common sense. But now you've got, you know, in California, how the prison guards union used to be a couple thousand members in the 70s or 60s, and, uh-huh. and now it's, 22 or 25,000 members, right. and they're very strong, yeah, and they're politically oriented.
Right, right.
You know, you get special interests that run this country, whether it's the 1% or you know, the elite, whatever it is. They do not really have to care about anybody else because they don't have to answer.
That's right.
I want to make a comment about something I saw in HuffPost today,
okay.
which is that the Chinese are saying, oh, it's really good about Occupy Wall Street, but you can't do it here. And the level of repression they've undergone to make sure that doesn't happen is apparently, you know, sort of like Tiananmen Square, you know, where they're actually making sure that nobody comes up with any dissent that actually indicates what they're in favor of, which means they're just stirring the pot.
Well, the good news is that we can't fit tanks down Wall Street, so
I think
that's one thing we don't have to worry about.
Not sure that's true. but I bought a bumper sticker the other day, and I really like it. And I'm gonna say it to you and let you go because I didn't want to get too far afield on you.
All right,
but
that's
it
fine.
Is the first duty of government is to protect the powerless against the powerful. And that came from the Code of Hammurabi, which we know is the first recorded set of laws.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we've got a lot of confusion in this country about what's appropriate. And I'd like to see a lot of those people that are in, I call them the neo-gilded agers, to be removed, you know? I mean, the people in their own voting districts ought to get rid of people like Cantor and that. But they're not going to do it because their own self-interest is too tied up with what's right in front of our faces. If I can switch it like that.
Well, thank you so much for your call, listener. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, please call back again. All right. Yeah, he makes a great point. You know, we're coming to the close of the show, but, you know, we always try to finish on some kind of a note to say that the power's in your hands.
That's
you know,
right.
And we try to encourage the people and give them a sense of power to understand that we can make the change provided we have the education. I understand that we, like, you know, John called up earlier and we have a difference of opinion on certain people, but If you just break it down to the most basic elements of protecting civil liberties, it should be pretty simple to understand based on their record who is for and who is against, and we should be able to figure out who is in the pocket of the elite.
Yeah, there's a broad potential coalition in this country between conservatives and liberals, Democrats and Republicans that could be formed to return power to the people, mm-hmm. to break up this corporate governance, corporate control of our government.
Well, the key is remember, don't let the media dictate to you who the front runner is, because I know a lot of people will say, oh, I won't vote for so-and-so because, well, he doesn't stand a chance. I'm wasting my vote. No, the power is with you. The media doesn't dictate who you vote for. The media can't and shouldn't dictate who we elect. We are the people. It's a republic. We have a choice. Don't let the media tell you who to vote for. Vote based on what you see as the merits of the individual. Vote because these people protect the republic.
Exactly. No, I completely agree with you. I never vote for someone just based on their quote-unquote electability. You know, I'm going to vote on somebody because they represent me, because I agree with what they're saying.
And I agree with you, Gus. And I think that the real debate in this country should be between people like Dennis Kucinich and Ron Paul, who neither of whom are in the pocket of this corporate, this financial elite that runs our country. They have different perspectives on right. size of government, how much it should be involved in people's lives.
You can easily look at someone's fundraising capacity and you can understand where their interests lie. And just to reiterate, Nancy Pelosi is firmly in the pocket of the big money.
Look where the money and look where, you know, when Obama ran last time and people said, oh, he's, you know, grassroots and all that stuff. But I said, well, he got $700 million and he didn't get it from Boy Scouts. He's getting it from Wall Street and the big
right.
corporations. And then when Gus and I did some more research on his background, actually it was Wayne Madsen, the independent journalist, did, we found out that his family is CIA, that apparently, and it's a very murky trail, but it certainly seems like his grandfather was a CIA operative in Lebanon. His grandmother was a CIA paymaster at a bank in Honolulu and Hawaii. And the first firm that he worked for was out of law school.
And his stepfather and his mother and his biological father. Anyway, that brings us to the end of the show. And you know, if you want to get in contact with us, find us at incontextreport.com.
We have a couple announcements, too.
Go ahead and run through those.
On Saturday, October 22nd at 2 p.m., Gus and Marchand and I will be appearing at the Greenwich Public Library, 101 West Putnam Avenue in Greenwich, for a reading of the one-act play Mark Twain versus the Imperialists, which was written by me. And we'll have a discussion. It's about Mark Twain's political writings. And we'll be available after the play the three of us to discuss the relevance of Mark Twain's political views to today's America. And on our show next Monday, that's October 24th at noon, we're going to have Mark Dyson, who's the author of Big Brother, The Orwellian Nightmare Come True. It's a study of modern government high-tech surveillance and what it means to our personal liberty and our privacy. So that's coming up on our next show on Monday, October 24th at noon.
All right, and that does it for us today. Have a great day, everybody, and we'll see you again next week.
Thanks for listening.
Take care. God bless the Republic.